First of all, shalom to everyone. Hope that everyone had a wonderful week, a healthy week. I'm very excited to be coming back for this second part of our series, Holy Women During the Holy Days. I'm very excited to start to get to learn with you all this evening. So last week, just as a quick recap, we discussed the Torah reading for Rosh Hashanah on the first day. And we talked about Sarah, we talked about Hagar, we talked about the Haftorah of the first day, which was about Chana. And what we discussed was that we really understood through the role modeling of our mothers what it meant to engage in tefillah. When all hope was lost, we were encouraged to be like a Sarah and like a Chana, to reach out and to go into the most inner parts of ourselves and connect that with HaKadosh Baruch Hu to request that the status quo is not good enough and that we want to go higher. We want to see more. We were encouraged not to be like Hagar, who represented a person who accepted the status quo and who in the face of challenge abandoned her son and did not engage in tefillah the way that Sarah and Chana did. And so through the Torah reading, we were able to see through these holy women how it is that we are supposed to engage in tefillah during Rosh Hashanah. When we go into the innermost sanctions of ourselves and we reach out to Hashem, where we look at our lives and we say that the status quo isn't good enough, we need better. And we connect to Hashem in this amazing way. Tonight, I would like to look at the second day of Rosh Hashanah and its Torah reading. Now, it's a complex, it is a dramatic, and it is a challenging Torah reading. We read on the second day of Rosh Hashanah that of the Akedah. The Akedah truly is one of the most dramatic parts of Tanakh. And although we come away from the Akedah thinking that our heroes are Abraham and Yitzchak, and it is true they are, I'd like to discuss the hidden character of the Akedah, someone who's tucked away at the end, who I think represents something so crucial to us as we approach Rosh Hashanah. Who am I talking about? I'm talking about Rivka. Now, Rivka usually has no association with Rosh Hashanah. We talk about Sarah, Hagar, Chana, Rachel as the mothers and the role models of Rosh Hashanah. But Rivka is almost never mentioned as one of the people associated with Rosh Hashanah. But what I'd like to do this evening is to really delve into the story of the Akedah in a way perhaps that we haven't before, and to see how Rivka plays such a crucial role and represents such a crucial person to the Akedah, to Avraham Avinu himself. So if you join me in the sheet, if you go into the chat, you can get onto the link. And right now I'm going to share my screen with you all here as well. I'd like to delve into the Akedah with you and talk a little bit where we see Rivka and discuss why it is that we mention her during the story, and furthermore, why we discuss Rivka on Rosh Hashanah. So as I mentioned, the Akedah is one of the most challenging, complex, and truly dramatic stories. And although I'd love to go through this story in great depth, because of time, I'm going to have to go a little bit fast and discuss it from a particular angle. But obviously, as we are approaching Rosh Hashanah, I very much encourage all of you to really revisit this story as we do year and year in, again and again, to really appreciate its great depth. So what I'd like to just start off with is just a recap of the story before we go through the text itself. And to really show how unique its ending of the Akedah really is. So we start off with a very dramatic request. God calls out to Abraham and says, I want you to take your son, your only son, the son that you love, and I want you to bring him to Har HaMoriah and bring him up as a sacrifice. Now, the previous perek to the Akedah was the banishment of his other son, Yishmael. So here we have Abraham, who already banished one son, and is now being asked to take his last remaining son and bring him up as a korban. He's about to sacrifice everything with this request. And Abraham goes, and he takes all the items necessary, and he brings his son with him, and he climbs up the mountain. And in a dramatic exchange, Yitzchak, his son, says, "Dad, what are we doing here?" And Abraham says, "Don't worry, Hashem will provide the korban, my son," vaguely kind of suggesting that perhaps it's him who will be the korban. Yitzchak doesn't run away. He doesn't object. And the pasuk tells us that they go together on this mission. And as we see that Abraham gets to the top of the mountain, he binds his son Yitzchak, and he's about to fulfill this remarkable request, something that makes absolutely no sense at all. And he is, in the moment, taking his hand back with his knife, ready to slaughter his son as a sacrifice. And as the reader, we're in this story, and our hearts are pounding, and we're saying, how is this going to end? And all of a sudden, he's about to bring down his hand on his son when a voice is called out from the heavens and says, "Abraham, stop. Don't do what you're about to do. Hashem now knows that you are dedicated to him in the most committed way. Don't sacrifice your only son, Yitzchak." And instead, what happens is he finds a ram. He offers that ram in his son's stead. And then Hashem blesses him with brachot and hope for the future. And we're almost relieved. Our hearts actually catch up with us. We see this moment as inspiration, as relief. It's amazing. And if I'm writing the story, I want to end the story right here. I want everyone who's reading the story to now walk out and say, "Wow, that was incredible. Look at that commitment of Avraham Avinu. Look and what levels human beings could achieve in their connection to God." And yet, if we look at the text of the Akedah, which is highlighted to you here on the source sheet in blue, the story doesn't end there. In Pasuk Chaf, it starts to tell us, after these things, it was told to Abraham saying, "Oh, remember your brother and his wife, your sister-in-law Milcah? They too are having lots of children." And then it goes on to tell us the names of each of these children. Pasuk Chaf Aleph tells us about Utz, about Buz, about Kumiel, about Aram. The next pasuk continues on that one of his sons, Betuel, also has a child, and that child's name is Rivka. So in total, when you're reading about Nahor and Milcah, they have 8 sons, plus a granddaughter, Rivka. The concluding pasuk tells us, "Upilag shosha maruma." The Pilegesh of Nahor also had children, and it goes on to add another 4. So in total, we are learning about 12 children that are born to Nahor, and this is how the story ends. And you're so puzzled. I just read the most incredible, mesmerizing, dramatic story in Tanakh about how Abraham gave up almost everything for God. He was standing before Yitzchak, ready to sacrifice him, knowing that he banished his son Ishmael. He was about to kill his son Yitzchak, and that he would be left with nothing. And in that moment, Hashem calls out and says, "Stop," and blesses him. And the story should end there. And yet we go through this genealogy about Avram's brother and about his granddaughter Rivka being born. And the question is why the story is so good. The story is so dramatic. It's kind of left with a womp womp. You're left trying to figure out, why is this piece here? Put this piece next Parsha. Put this piece in the relevant information when we learn about Rivka. Why are we learning about the genealogy about Abraham's brother, specifically about the birth of Rivka, when it doesn't seem to match up to the story? Rashi makes a fascinating comment. And if you look at Rashi here on the page, he asks a similar question. Ubetuel Yalad et Rivka. When we go through the genealogy is mentioning all the children that are born to Nahor and Milcah, the brother of Abraham. But there is one grandchild that's mentioned, and that is Rivka. Betuel has a daughter named Rivka. Now Rashi wants to know, why is this going on? And so he comments, Kol hayichusin halululo niktivu ela bishvil pasuk zeh. The whole point of this genealogy is specifically to mention the birth of Rivka. That the whole point of it was zoomed into the fact that we want to know Betuel had a granddaughter named Rivka. This only strengthens our question. Why? Why is the birth of Rivka so important to this story that it has to end one of the most amazing stories of Tanakh? What does this add for us? And if I can put it into context for us in regards to Rosh Hashanah, I want to further the question. Why is it important that we read this on Rosh Hashanah? Okay, if I'm learning this piece of Tanakh, I might have this question. But when I'm learning about what I read about Rosh Hashanah on the second day of Yantif, it would be very easy to cut this section out. Just read the section of the Akedah if it has a connection to Rosh Hashanah. Why am I adding this specific piece in specifically on Rosh Hashanah? So it's really two questions. Why in general are we learning about the birth of Rivka in this story? And the second question is, what significance does it have for us in understanding about the special day of Rosh Hashanah? So in order to answer this question, what I'd like to do is I'd like to look at the Akedah through the lens of two women who have written about it extensively and who I think shed a really important light into the story of the Akedah. And through that light, I hope to answer that question, why the Akedah ends with the genealogy leading up to Rivka's birth, and why it is that we read it on Rosh Hashanah. So if I can draw your attention to the first woman scholar who discusses the Akedah, it comes from Dr. Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg in her book called The Murmuring Deep. It's a book like this. It's a tremendous piece, a tremendous book. And in her book, she discusses a little bit about the Akedah. And I just took a very small part of it, but I think it sheds an interesting light on the Akedah. She discusses a midrash that is associated with this part of Tanakh, with the Akedah, which is that Avraham engages in a conversation with Hashem, and he wants to be assured that although he didn't sacrifice his son, that what he was going to do would last for future generations. And so Aviva Zornberg says the following in her essay. The closure offered by the Midrash is a vision of an animal caught in a thicket, in a tangle, by its horns. So if we look at the story of the Akedah, we know that what happens is that Avraham is told not to sacrifice Yitzchak, but instead he is to lift his eyes, if you look at Pasuk Yigimel, and as he lifts his eyes, Vayar vihine ayil, he sees an ayil, achar, from behind, Ne'achaz b'savach b'karnav, whose horns are entangled in a bush with thorns. Vayalech Avram vayikach et ha'ayel. Avram takes the ram, vayaluhu la'ula tachat b'no, and he gives it up as a korban in place of his son. So the Midrash talks about a certain discussion that Avraham has with Hashem and says, I didn't get to do what I was supposed to. I gave this ram instead. What's the significance of it? So Aviva Zornberg says, here, the ram substitutes for Isaac, but the emphasis is on the shofar, the instrument wrought of these complicated horns, and on the animal's position from behind. Interestingly enough, she says, the shofar blown on Rosh Hashanah to evoke God's forgiveness may not be straight or simple, and it should be directed upward as an emblem for the complex human being, subject of many attempts to detranslate and retranslate his experience. The shofar cries with a human cry produced by human breath. Aviva Zornberg is quoting Midrash that says, Hashem says, you know what will take place of your son not being sacrificed? The ram's horn. The fact that you offered the ram is fine, but his horns, that is what's going to stand the test of time. How so? The thorns were curved. They were entangled in the bush. What does it represent? It represents God's forgiveness. That God's forgiveness is also not simple. It's not straight. It's entangled. Just as human beings are complex, and that we have to reevaluate ourselves every year, and we have to look as to who we are, the horn of a ram represents this curvy path back to God. Says the Midrash, that will stand the test of time. Not the actual korban, but the blowing of this horn. What's interesting is that when you look at the position of the ram in the pasuk, it says that the ram was achar, was from behind. And the Midrash wants to know, why is it that it's telling me that it's from behind? Is it telling me about a specific place that the ram was, or is it something more? So Aviva Zornberg continues, does this refer to the space behind Avraham, hidden or other? Or is it referring to time after, that the ram whose horns will offer atonement for the future is to be found in the world of Achar Hadevarim Ha'ela, after these things, where what lies behind the apparent facts, what happened before, the residue of the past, suffuse the present. And what's fascinating is that the play of words the Midrash does in telling us that the ram was found behind Avraham is that it's not necessarily telling us its specific position, but rather it's telling us that the ram will represent a time, meaning the past, achar, backwards. How so? When we do tshuva, when we go back to our past and we reevaluate ourselves and we think, how can we turn around who we are? The sound of the shofar blasts. It reminds us of that ram who is entangled in the bush. And it inspires us to think about our future, where we're going, where we're moving towards. And so this cry of the shofar doesn't represent the fact that the ram was literally behind Avraham, but that it represented all that Avraham was in the past and how it was going to bridge the future. So she concludes with the following. What lies behind him is the future of his past, the once inevitable consequence of those traumatizing messages, and a dynamic possibility that it would be his children, like him, will work to transform and translate the enigmas of their own past. This is God's offer, a perpetual return of the shofar cry for memory and transfiguration. What Dr. Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg is saying is that the shofar represents a past that bridges into our present and our future. When Avraham was ready to sacrifice Yitzchak and he was traumatized, he was about to give up everything. He banished his son Yishmael, and so he no longer had that son. And the promise that Hashem made for him that he would be a great nation and that he would have many children was lingering on the fact that Yitzchak would survive and become a great leader. And as Hashem said, now sacrifice that son to me, it wasn't just the father giving up a son. It was now Avraham giving up his dream to be the future of Am Yisrael. It would have to come from somewhere else. His son Yitzchak would die as a sacrifice, and so would the promise that God gave him. And yet he was willing to do so. He was so steadfast in doing God's will that although everything that happens before him could have traumatized him at this moment, he is told, don't kill your son. Stop. You're right. We're not going to give up on the promise I gave you. Instead, give this ram as a sacrifice. And what will be the symbol of the fact that you almost lost it all, but that you were willing to stay true to my command? It will be the horns of this animal, entangled, complicated, and it will blow. And as it blows, it will stand the test of time, that as all of your future generations will revisit their past and will look to see where they are, that they will continue to be inspired by its sound, saying, if my forefather Abraham would be able to do such a committed act of God, then I too can change around my past. I too can go forward. And not only that, it represents what the future lies ahead for Abraham, that that wasn't the end of his story. That by saying that this will now take a toll on future generations is saying that this story will continue for all future time. Now, I'd like to look at this story in yet another important way. And this is by Dr. Erica Brown on her book, Return. She says the following: when the shofar is blown on Rosh Hashanah, all time collapses. We revisit our master story again and again, understanding that we are part of an ancient treasured history, one of entanglement and also redemption. The problem is to know when we are stuck and when we are just at the beginning of a breakthrough. Often the very same moment can appear to be both. We mistake trouble for possibility or do not see harm or temptation right ahead. Abraham saw a ram in a thicket, a live creature stuck in brambles. He offered up the animal as a testimony to a moment when he was ready to give one thing, but was asked for another instead. His destiny could have taken one turn. Instead, it took another. Erica Brown says that the Akedah represents that although Avram thought he was going to be doing one thing, in a split moment where he thought that that thing he had to do would end up crushing all his hopes and dreams, it actually was the beginning of his future. Although he thought that by sacrificing his son, that that would be it, out of nowhere, a ram appeared, entangled, and he'd have to sacrifice that. And by offering up that animal would be a testimony that he was willing to give it all up for God, but yet his destiny took a different turn. Destiny does not always introduce itself. We don't know that when we're going through the motions, how it is that we are going to end up. We have a chance to encounter that ends up changing our lives because we are able to say at a moment's notice, Hineni, I am here, I am ready. So if we look back at the story of Avram Avinu, we see that throughout the Akedah, he continuously says Hineni, and that's highlighted for you in yellow. When God calls him, he says, I am ready. What you want me to do, I am here. And he does so when he's told to sacrifice his son, and he does so when he's told to sacrifice the ram instead. Dr. Erica Brown is trying to suggest that what's going on in the Akedah is that Avraham is told to do something and he puts his whole heart in it. And in a moment's notice, everything turns, his destiny changes. And where he thinks he's going to lose it all, it is exactly at that moment that he gains it all. What's going on here by these two scholars? What do I think they are trying to gain at here? In their commentary to the Akedah. What I think Dr. Zorenberg and Dr. Brown are trying to say is that the Akedah represents Avraham in a situation where he is about to lose everything and thinks that there is no way to move forward or no future. And then there is a small moment where the seeds to his salvation are actually being planted, although he can't see its full blossomings, but that it continues to show a destiny that he is starting even at the moment of what he thinks is destruction. What is fascinating is that the story of the Akedah ends with Abraham trying to show his devotion to God, where he thinks that he has to give it up, and he thinks that that's the end of the story. But what gets tucked in at the end of the Akedah? After all these things, the brother of Abraham is having children. And who is born from those children? Rivka. Because who is Rivka? Rivka is the granddaughter of Nahor, the brother of Abraham. Which means the following. We know in the next couple of parshiot that follow the Akedah, Avraham is going to ask his servant to find a wife for his son Yitzchak. And while he was going to sacrifice Yitzchak, at the end of that story, what happens? The birth of the wife of his son is being told to us, because the birth of his wife represents the future, where it is that the story, the destiny, is going. And what is fascinating is that when we think that the destruction is there and there's no way out, the seeds of our salvation are actually being planted. When Avraham thinks that he won't have a future, and even though relieved by the fact that he will not have to sacrifice Yitzhak, but rather he had to sacrifice the ram, he doesn't know where this is going. He doesn't know what the future will lie for Yitzhak, but the Torah tells us what's going on at that exact moment, unbeknownst to Avraham. Avraham only finds this out later, that his brother is having children, and that those children are having children, and that that child, Rivka, will one day marry his son and continue on the journey of Am Yisrael. It will continue to move the people forward. Why do we read this on Rosh Hashanah? On Rosh Hashanah, when we look at our lives, and when we do teshuva, teshuva means to return back, to look at our past deeds, to what it is that we've done, we can feel a tremendous amount of regret, a tremendous amount of shame, a tremendous amount of disillusion. And we probably think to ourselves, we can't get out of this. What have we done? What have we become? And yet it's in those moments when we revisit the past, that's exactly where, unbeknownst to us, the seeds of the future perhaps were being planted. In the moment, they were a bad moment. In the moment, it was a tense moment. In the moment, it was a lapse of judgment. But maybe those things actually define how our future will actually turn out. Maybe it's those seeds that are being planted in those moments that allow us to then get to future points, to a future destiny. If I can, I'd like to share a personal story that happened to me that I think sums this idea up. I was very blessed to be a counselor on an NCSY summer program called GIVE way back in 2010. And if you recall, there were horrible fires in the Carmel Mountains. And our group, our camp, dedicated some time to go help restore the forest that had been burnt during these times. And when I got there, I thought I was going to roll up my sleeves, and I thought what I was going to do was going to be replanting trees that had been burnt from this fire. And when I got there, I learned something fascinating. When I got there, the person in charge says, you know what? In a fire, in a wildfire, when the smoke is all over the place and the winds are blowing and the fire is raging, the seeds of the trees are being tossed around and they're being implanted into the ground. So when the ground is burning and the fire is making everything look destroyed, the seeds of the trees are actually flying all over the place and they're actually being implanted into the ground. He said to us, you volunteers, you think you're coming to build trees. No, no, no. The earth will heal itself. Those seeds that were planted in that fire will then sprout and they will grow new trees. What you need to do now as volunteers is that you need to create a boundary so that if, God forbid, there's another fire, it will stop. But in the destruction of the forest itself, the seeds of its renewal are being planted. What's going on in the Akedah? Avraham thinks it's the end. It's the destruction of his future. But what does the Akedah end with? It ends with the genealogy of the birth of Rivka. Rivka is born. She is the seed. She is the future to Abraham and obviously to Yitzchak and to the continuation of the Jewish people. And why do we read this on Rosh Hashanah? Because as we stand before God, ashamed of our past, thinking that our past will define us, and we feel empty, that there's nothing to gain or learn from the past, we hear the cry of the shofar that represents that ram that was put in the place of Yitzchak, where Abraham was told, it's not over. This is the beginning. And what happens? We learn Rivka is born at that moment as well. Why? Because she will continue the future of Am Yisrael. And so when we stand before God on Rosh Hashanah, let us look into our sidurim, look into our hearts, look into our past. Let's do a tshuva and realize that from the darkest and most challenging of times, our seeds of salvation are being planted. I hope that next week we'll be able to learn more together. And I appreciate everyone learning this evening. So I think my time is up, and wishing everybody a great week.